Today we have a special show for you. The authors of a brand new book, Earl Scruggs, Banjo Icon, have given us some time. The names are Gordon Castellanero and David L. Russell. Brand new book on Roman and Littlefield. And what they do and what we'll talk about is they go back and they resource. By I mean re-source, not resource, but resource. Some of the stories that you knew about Earl, they add more features to those stories with new interviews and new information, and they bring it all current, and they give a new insight, I think, into the legend that is Earl Scruggs, whose music we enjoy so often and is so pervasive in the bluegrass field. So in the second hour, we'll talk to the authors of Earl Scruggs, Banjo Icon, Gordon Castellanero and David L. Russell, about Earl Scruggs, Banjo Icon. I love this book. So nice of these fellows to stop by and just kind of talk a little bit about what they did. Well, I'm really happy to welcome to Unreal Bluegrass some very, very accomplished authors. David L. Russell. Hi, David.
Hello, Steve.
And Gordon Castellanero. How are you, Gordon?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Steve.
I'm thrilled to have you. And the reason for our opportunity to speak is this wonderful book that I have enjoyed so much, Earl Scruggs, Banjo Icon. And I've read it, and I've gone through it, and it's just a wonderful story about Earl Scruggs. There's so much to do. I'll tell you, the listeners right away, it's on Roman and Littlefield. And what was the actual publication date on this, fellas?
It came out, I think, March 17th of this year.
Okay. And Earl Scruggs, here was my question, and there's a little bit of discussion in this in the book between why the both of you got together and why you took on this project, which is formidable, a formidable topic. And here's my question to you. Did you realize, even though you knew who Earl Scruggs was and you knew how important he was, once you got into this project, which is so well-sourced and resourced and just in the writing, both of you, let me just say this on the air, there is this wonderful connective tissue between these events that take from the beginning of Earl all the way through current times his still commanding influence, and the writing in between these sources is top notch. I mean, it's just wonderful. It's just wonderful authorship. But when you got involved in this, did you think this is bigger than we really thought, even though we knew going in it was a large topic?
Well, it certainly consumed our lives for quite some time. In fact, so much to the point where my wife was actually calling herself Amy Scruggs. if that tells you, that tells you. But no, it was a huge, it was a large project, yes, but it was a serious labor of love for both of us. I mean, we love Earl. And we were just absolutely thrilled that we got to do this, and we were very, very grateful to have the blessing of the Scruggs family and the participation of everyone who was involved. We did a grand total of 71 interviews.
Wow.
And, just a fun project to do. And I would say that probably to answer your question a little bit better, when we first got started on it, we had ourselves a working outline that we went with, and the way we initially designed it ended up going through two more changes before we got to what became the book itself. And that was because the way we originally structured it, yeah, it got much bigger than we thought. Kind of like some sections we thought that we were just going to do a little bit on. We found out, well, there's so much more to do for this, and then more to do for this. And so it just kind of took a life of its own, and in the end, it just came out to be a really good book that we're very proud of.
It's wonderful, David. A little bit about what your anticipation was getting into this project.
Well, first of all, the writing of a Scruggs biography, I now call it. It's a bucket list item that's now been accomplished for me.
Hmm.
Way back when I was doing my graduate studies at Michigan State, I had passed by a magazine rack there in the library. I saw a picture of Earl on one of the country music magazine covers and thought, I'd really like to write this guy's biography. But it's, as you know, how life gets in the way, I never got around to it because I just got busy living life. And so I never forgot about wanting to do it, and I try to keep my ear and my eye to the world of academe, see who might be writing about Earl, and nobody had. And then I had moved back to the Detroit area from Atlanta, Georgia, and contacted Gordon, who, by the way, was a banjo student of mine back in 1979, a very good one, I should say. And we kept in touch, and I know he had, I remembered he had published the book already and said, hey, would you be interested in co-authoring a biography of Earl Scruggs? And at the time, he wasn't really up for the ride because he had other issues going on, but he said he would be glad to help me out and encourage me to do an oral history, that it would be probably a much better read that way. And then later on in 2014, that same year, Lee Gordon, it was the day before Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. he had contacted me and said, hey, you still want to do that project? I think I might want in on that. So we started into it in December of 2014, started mm-hmm. doing research, interviews, and writing, and didn't stop till 2016 when it was completed.
I mean, it's very thorough, and you know, people, I think, in general, fans of bluegrass, and certainly, and I play a little banjo also, you know, we kind of know the general story of Earl, you know, from his childhood days and all those things, but this really takes everything from that point. You add more light to those early days, and if you read through this book, it goes almost tracks, don't you think? Gentlemen, it almost tracks. You could almost say that a biography of Earl Scruggs almost tracks the evolution of music in the 20th century, and for several reasons. And you have chapters about this, and I want you to talk about it. You know, here you have this guy playing in a string band, and all of a sudden he's accessed. Not all of a sudden, it's because he's a genius musician, but he has radio exposure, and then there's TV exposure, and then it just keeps growing and growing as the mediums change. Earl seems to be right there at the forefront of all of these things, exposing more and more through movies and everything else. It almost tracks. It almost can track the evolution of music in the 20th century in America. And there's more to it than that. But, I mean, talk a little bit about that passage of time as Earl goes through all these different changes.
Well, you really just see that as the time changed, you kind of see Earl changing along with it. And it just goes from, during his childhood, during the Depression years, and kind of how music was a mainstay in the area where he grew up. He came from a very musical family, and music was a way for them to escape the hardships of the Depression at the times. But when he got to Nashville in 1945 and joined Bill Monroe's band, I mean, you think about what was going on. World War II had just ended, so people were hungry for entertainment. And so the timing couldn't have been better. And when he made his debut at the Grand Ole Opry on December 8th, 1945, mm-hmm. he single-handedly, really, in one night, not only did he contribute to, you know, the sound of what became bluegrass music with Bill Monroe, but he changed the way, not only the way the banjo was played, but also the perception of the five-string banjo. You know, it had always kind of been looked upon as a prop for comedians in their comedy bits. And now all of a sudden it was being looked at as a serious instrument, a solo instrument. He made very much a part of bluegrass music, what the electric guitar is to rock and roll.
Good. Oh, that's a good analogy.
Yeah, absolutely. And then he certainly, you know, he gave it that sound that, you know, that it has today. And then with the changing of the times, I mean, when he got on radio, they started out at WSM Radio. They had a 15-minute radio show, and then that certainly led to the television show, and that's all and thanks to Colin T. Williams, the president of Martha White Mills Company, who gave him a huge sponsorship. And, of course, television was a very new medium at that time, so in 1955, when they went on the air, now all of a sudden people who had just heard them now got a chance to see them. And then, of course, with the popularity of television, you know, the huge break, you know, came for them certainly in 1962 with the Beverly Hillbillies because of Paul Henning. Paul Henning needed a theme for his new show, and he kind of just had this little ditty in his head that he sang out to a piano player friend of his who kind of put the music to it. And then he saw Flatten Scruggs perform at the Ash Grove Coffee House in Los Angeles thought they were the right ones to do his theme. And, of course, there was a little resistance at first from Louise Scruggs, you know, who managed them, because she wasn't quite sure what, you know, stigma was going to be attached to Hillbillies because of the title of the Beverly Hillbillies. Yeah. And once they had screened the pilot, they decided to do it. Earl put the banjo right to the forefront, certainly, of the theme. And, you know, they ended up becoming a mainstay in American living rooms every week. And then, of course, certainly that went, you know, worldwide. And then there's Bonnie and Clyde in 1967 using Foggy Mountain Breakdown. And, yeah. I mean, I don't know what more could be said beyond that. Certainly, because of the popularity of Bonnie and Clyde, you have Foggy Mountain Breakdown now as the anthem of the five-string banjo.
It absolutely is. And I will tell you just from a personal point of view, David, I want you to comment on this in a minute also. And I'm probably not too far. I was born in 55, so certainly Beverly Hillbillies is something that I saw, and I appreciated what was going on there. But when I saw Bonnie and Clyde, all of my friends were talking about how many times they got shot in the final scene, and all I could think going home was, what was that sound? What was that sound when they're driving down the road? I could not. It was, and David, I mean, did it strike either of you that same way also? It's like, and I read in your book that, you know, it was deliberate that, you know, they were making the movie, and they wanted that sound, so they picked that perfect recording that Earl had done of Foggy Mountain Breakdown. But it took me forever to figure out what it was, how to find one, how to get one, how to try to play it. But is that a common experience to either one of you?
Well, I find it rather ironic that you know, Earl Scruggs, his banjo playing, particularly the 1949 Mercury recording, which was used for the Bonnie and Clyde film, A Foggy Mountain Breakdown, Jim Mills, Terry Bockham, all the great banjo players we know and love and listen to, refer to Earl that he sounded like a jackhammer or a Thompson submachine gun. And it's so odd that they used so many Tommy guns in that movie. It's an appropriate tune, I guess.
It is.
And I would say that I never thought of when I grew up in a half-Southern home. My mother came out of East Tennessee, so I had a lot of influence from that region as far as old-timey and bluegrass music went. But so I never really thought about, I never really associated banjo. I remember hearing the banjo on the Bonnie and Clyde film and going, whoa.
Yeah, what is that?
Because I'd heard, you know, Beverly Hill, yeah, what is that sound? And that's a banjo. And the banjo that I'd been exposed to was really sloppy-sounding claw hammer and really clumsy three-finger style that I remember seeing as a kid and listening to. But, so I never really thought about the Tommy gun aspect, but as I began to, you know, get into the banjo and listen to Earl and nothing but Earl, nobody else came close. And to this day, I don't think anybody comes close. I mean, we've got great banjo players like the great Sonny Osborne, who I love, mm-hmm. J.D. Crowe, all these great pickers. They are incredible pickers. But even they'll tell you that Earl's the man. He just had a way of pushing his heart and soul through his fingers into those strings, and it's just something that you can't teach somebody to do. He just had it.
It came out of him, and you document that so well in the book, because you're talking about Jimmy Mills and all those players now who are you know, jaw-dropping players, and certainly J.D. and Sonny and so many more, but they all are very, very deferential. When you talk about their accomplishments, first of all, they're all humble, but if you start talking about playing, they all say, Earl invented it, he was the guy, and nobody even comes close, and they don't even pretend that they do.
You know, he expanded the vocabulary, as you know. People were playing three-finger-style banjo when he was a kid. You know, Mack Woolbright, the blind banjo player that he saw.
That's right.
And there's a lesser-known mentioned banjo, Mack Crow,
mm-hmm.
Snuffy Jenkins, Smith Hammett, his cousin, and so forth. But Earl, he took that very clumsy style, as we all know, and he just expanded the vocabulary. He turned that thing from a Wright Brothers cover type plane into a jet fighter.
That's good. It's pretty accurate. And then I want the listener to know, by the way, if you just tuned in, I'm talking to the authors of Earl Scruggs' Banjo Icon, Gordon Castellanero and David Russell. You document that so well. And one of the things that I really enjoy about this book is it's so current. You go back to the beginning. But, you know, some of these people that you interview and talk to when you're expanding on the continued influence, these are kind of young people that are still, I mean, you have references in there to Ryan Cavanaugh, who happens to be a friend of mine, and a lot of players that are mm-hmm. still saying, that's the guy. And, you know, and if you talk to any of these people, that beautiful forward by Bela, by the way, but any of them will still say, so it almost makes you think after all this time that he had this magic, and he created the sound that many people, as you kind of reference in the book, he may have been the creator of the bluegrass sound. I mean, if you really think about mm-hmm. the timing of
without
that.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. So, and still people are trying to find it there. You know, he wrote a book about how to do it. That's what I tried to learn from. But people still are in awe of what he was able to produce. Like you said, in 1949, I love the passages in the book about people talk about different recordings of Foggy Mountain Breakdown and the album, the Yellow Album, that hits it. But that 49, they all talk about 49. And when you watch those guys listen to those tunes, they're just motionless.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're just frozen in time listening to it.
The other thing too is the Foggy Mountain Banjo album itself was also another influence that we found. In fact, the three things that always came up the most was either the 49 cut of Foggy Mountain Breakdown, the Ballad of Jed Clampett, or the Foggy Mountain Banjo album.
Oh yeah.
And you know, it's just amazing how when you listen to that record, especially if you listen to it loud, you know, just the clarity of notes in every single song, they're just so crisp. And I mean, that's, you know, that this goes to, you know, all those thousands of hours that he spent as a child practicing and adding, you know, syncopated rhythms to all those different roles that he came up with. You know, the way he refined the forward roll and then came up with a backward roll and alternating thumb roll. And then one of the other things that's fascinating too is that you know, he put a real emphasis on melody lines, and that mm-hmm. actually came from his mother. Because while he was showboating all of these hot licks, you know, his mother was the one who said to him, you know, if you're going to play a song, play it so it can be recognized.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So all you can know, play is Reuben.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I love that. I love that story in the book. And all these things are in the book. And so I want people to read them. But I love the way you deal with that issue and Reuben. And like, he played it for I don't know how many days or weeks in a row, because I think, was it also sort of concurrent with him developing this new style that kind of set him off? Was Reuben the thing that kind of, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. they're wonderful stories. And as I keep saying, I don't want to repeat this ad nauseum, but the writing in between these passages is just, it's wonderful. It's just wonderful writing. If the topic itself was not so amazing, that's about Earl, the writing itself, I really mean this, it's just wonderful writing. It's just, you're describing, you could have said, here's what they said, then they said this, and they said, then you take the time to incorporate those things in the text of the book and really pull it all together, and it's not just a way to transition from one quote to another, from one story. These are really well-written paragraphs and chapters, and the book is also just a wonderful bit of authorship, I think.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that a whole lot.
You know, and again, the book continues up, I say, current. We go through that. You go through that whole period where he was doing the Earl Scruggs Review with his family, and something that Earl really wanted to do. Let me ask you this: do you think? I don't know how to even get it. I was thinking about trying to get an analogy to where Earl fits. Was he just in the evolution of banjo playing? Let's try it this way: was he just a jump forward, or was he a jump forward and to the side? In other words, would we have had, it's all speculation, but you've done a lot of research, would we have had this driving, remarkable style that created, took a fairly common instrument and made it one that's, you know, that's elevated around the world, created a new form? Would we have had that dominance if we just would have waited another 30 years? Or was Earl one of those, was Earl like Einstein, didn't fit the normal progression of Newtonian physics, all right? He went somewhere else and came back. Did Earl make that sideways jump and then bring everybody else with him?
I think when Gordon and I have talked about this a lot, and we've talked with other people about this very subject, that in terms of what made Earl's tone and his sound so unique. I mean, you listen to a lot of banjo players, and they're great. Don Reno, a great banjo
mm-hmm.
player, created his own single-string style, and he also played three-finger style. But even Don admitted he didn't have the tone that Earl had. Ralph Stanley admitted he didn't have the tone that Earl had, that he brought something do the instrument in terms of timing and tone and feel that nobody else had. And I think a lot of it, and I think one of the things that's often overlooked, and Steve, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I tend to believe that part of what made Earl's playing so great were the people that he played with. He had Lester Flatt, a second to none rhythm player on guitar.
Yeah.
He had the Foggy Mountain Boys. I think in the book I had written in one section that the Foggy Mountain Boys with Lester Flatt, the whole gang, kind of created the rail system upon which Earl's train could ride.
Yeah, I love that phrase.
And, and one of the I remember when I wrote that, Gordon said, make sure to keep that in the text.
I love that phrase.
It's like there's a recording, Gordon, maybe you remember, it was a recording he played with Hilo Brown and his band, and Lester Flatt didn't make the
to Newport.
Yeah, that was at the Newport
mm-hmm.
Festival, yeah.
Yeah, and Earl played with Hilo Brown and his band, and there's a recording. The only recording I've listened to on that show, the Earl's playing John Henry in the key of G. Of course, so you know he categorically played that in B, and it was good playing, but it didn't really sound quintessential Earl.
Hmm.
He had great musicians backing him up, but it didn't sound the way Earl would sound with Lester and the Boys.
Okay.
So I just thought I'd bring that up a little bit in terms of Earl. Would it have made a difference? I think what really helped make the difference, maybe you agree with this, were the people he played with. I mean, they greased the skids. It's like all the planets lined up with the right people for him.
I think you maybe hit on something that I just never really could. But I think you're right. And they were together for a long time. And if they had replacements, they were equally talented. And those back in those days, and both of you guys can, and there are busy bands today, but they played all the time. They when they went in the studio, they weren't going to dub it and redo it and redo it. They were ready when they got there because they played all the time. They traveled all the time and played all the time. And I think you may have hit it that he was with great musicians for a long time, all the time, and it just made him that brilliance that he had just had a chance to become even more spectacular. Maybe that's it. I think you might be onto something there.
You know, the other thing, too, is, I was just going to say, you know, it's what Earl heard in his ear. You know, he had an ear for what would sound best. And, you know, sometimes it's, with Earl, it's what he didn't play that helped make him so great, too, because he, you know, he knew not to upstage anyone. He always knew when to come in with the right licks at the right time. He knew how to back, you know, other musicians up, you know, just the way it would, you know, accent them better. You know, he always added, you know, to the overall sound of whatever he was playing, whatever song was playing, and just to make it better. You know, and that's something else that I think is, you know, pretty amazing about him.
Right. He didn't get above his raisin in his playing.
You're right. You're correct. That's true. And he had all that taste as we're. I want to let you guys go here in a bit. He had all that taste to know what to do, and he had all the skills to make it come off. Like he's behind someone, he's not overpowering, he's playing it, he had the skills to let his taste and judgment come through almost perfectly. I mean, we're talking about him, but the terms we're using are very high and lofty, but they're deserved, and I think the book helps demonstrate why they are, but everybody talks about Earl in this fashion, and it's undeniable. He's still the king, and when he started this sound, everybody's still trying to go back and find that sound. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they're all... Go ahead, Gordon, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, when you ask, you know, different people, you know, different musicians, who was the most influential, you know, to them, if you talk to a guitarist, you'll come up with a whole bunch of different names.
Right.
If you talk to a piano player, there's a whole bunch of different names. Talk to a drummer, there's a whole bunch of different names. But if you talk to a banjo player, there's one name that comes up every single time automatically, and that's Earl Scruggs.
You're dead on it. David, did you have a comment?
Oh, I was just going to basically that Gordon kind of covered for me. Earl Scruggs' name is just there. I mean, you may hear the occasional Eddie Peabody for the four-string players, but Gordon, that's why he's such a good friend. We read each other's minds. I think he answered it.
Mm. Well, listen, congratulations. The book is Earl Scruggs, Banjo Icon. I've been chatting. Thanks so much, by the way, Gordon Castanera and David L. Russell. It's on Roman and Littlefield. I thoroughly enjoyed the book from all accounts, from the sourcing, the writing, the thoroughness, going back to the beginning, and it's so current. I mean, it's so current that even if people listening to this program think they've read articles or texts about Earl, they need to get this. It has a different point of view, different coming from a different angle. It's better. The sourcing is phenomenal, and it's current up to the almost to the day. I mean, it's okay, printed earlier this year, but still, it's just a wonderful effort, and you guys must be very proud of what you've done. I hope you are.
Oh, yeah. We're excited about it. It's an honor.
It's an honor, yeah. Congratulations. Well, listen, thanks so much for coming, being available, and I know you guys are busy. I'll let you go, but I'll catch up to you somewhere down the road. Maybe we'll get to chat in person somewhere.
Absolutely.
All right,
thanks
look forward
so much.
To it.
All right.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, guys. See you, bye.
All right. All right, man. Take care.